This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind space in the metaverse where a big subject becomes clear in less than half an hour with the assistance of the top experts. This week, how bad are things getting for poorer Britons and what could be done to help? It's been a time of bad news. We've heard that energy bills are likely to be thousands of pounds higher than was expected just a short time ago. The Bank of England has increased interest rates again and warned of the twin threat of inflation and a recession. So, most people will be affected and many will be in real trouble. What could or should government and others do to help? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's try and quantify how much of a problem people are having now and are likely to have going into the winter. Joining me in the briefing room is consumer affairs journalist and Moneybox Live presenter Felicity Hanna. Felicity Hanna, what's the latest estimate of what's going to happen to energy prices in the autumn?
At the moment, the cap is just short of £2,000. And the current prediction by the energy analysts Cornwall Insight is that it could rise by 77%. So to give you the staggering number in full, Cornwall Insight reckons the average annual energy bill is going to reach £3,582 in the autumn. And it thinks that by January, when it gets adjusted again, we'll be looking at a typical annual bill of more than £4,200. These are just staggering numbers.
Now, what can we say about who is affected most by this?
I think everybody listening will think, well, I'm affected by this, because I think this is the national conversation at the moment. But where we're looking at bills heading, it's just absolutely beyond the reach of the poorest households. Now, among those households, you're seeing a lot of pensioners, people with disabilities, single parents are among the most likely to struggle for sort of obvious reasons, you know, single income and a family. If you look at what we've seen from the Office for National Statistics, people between the age of 55 and 74, they're the most likely to be cutting their energy use right now. If you think about the number of people who will move into fuel poverty because of these rising energy bills, it's really, really staggering. So academics at the University of York have predicted that 15 million households will have been pushed into fuel poverty by January next year. Now, 15 million is a big number, but to put it in real context, that is more than half of the households in the UK. That is staggering.
The government, of course, is already offering help to people. So how much help are they offering? And then take us back through what that means the shortfall is.
So the government did roll out some help back in May, and it was, you know, quite significant, quite expensive help in May. All households in England, Wales and Scotland are being given a £400 discount on their fuel bills. That starts rolling out in October. We saw additional payments for the 8 million lowest income households, people who receive universal credit, tax credits, pension credits, other means-tested benefits. They're getting £650. There was £150 for disabled people. Pensioner households were going to get an extra £300. So there was a lot of money there that added up to about £1,200 for the very poorest household. But when you're seeing energy bills rising by more than £2,000, you can see that it kind of barely touches the sides. It would have been a significant difference back in May, but the prices that we're potentially looking at now make this not, it doesn't go as far as it would have.
So just to be clear, the expected energy increases in costs to the poorest may be up to double what they're receiving in help from the government.
Yes, exactly. The amount of help the very poorest families are going to get is perhaps only half of what they might face in terms of their rising energy bills.
Energy costs is one part of an equation that also has inflation, i.e. vastly increased costs in it. How are those likely to impact upon poorer households?
The kind of costs that we're talking about, things like energy bills or fuel bills or the cost of food, things that we're seeing real, real rises in. And of course, those are essentials. They're very hard for people to cut back on. And they already make up a significant chunk of the spending of households that are on those lower incomes. We've seen prices at the pump just absolutely rocket this year. They're easing slightly at the moment. They're still way higher than they were at the start of the year. We're seeing food inflation that's outstripping general inflation. I saw one figure that said food inflation is running close to 10%, and that's adding something like £450 a year to a typical family's grocery shop. It's food, it's fuel, it's energy, and those are not expenses that people can avoid.
Is it fair to say that the poorer people in society, well, firstly, it's going to be a much larger group than it has been for a while. And secondly, the problems they face are the biggest they've faced for a while.
I think that there are growing numbers of people who were just about managing before, who were struggling, but they could just about make ends meet. And now this is becoming an impossible situation for them. And by the time you're talking about energy bills of more than £4,000, you may as well say they've got to pay it in unicorns. They don't have it. They can't get it. They're going to find this situation impossible.
Felicity Hannah. The canary in the poverty coal mine is often the charity sector. So what is the situation like for the organisations dealing directly with the cost of living crisis? Nicole Sykes is Director of Policy and Communications at Pro Bono Economics. They analyse the financial health of charities. Nicole Sykes, what are the organisations you work with expecting over the next few months?
About 7 in 10 charities are telling us that they're expecting increased demand over the next few months. So a lot more pressure on them. But at the same time, quite worried about their finances and how they're going to meet that swell of demand.
Let's look at those two things in sequence. Which charities are most expecting higher demand, and how much higher demand are they expecting?
Food banks and baby banks and debt advice charities are already seeing those upticks. But there's also a lot of charities that deal with sort of the knock-on effects of poverty that are also quite worried. So organisations like mental health charities and people dealing with domestic abuse and addiction, all of those kind of things go up as well when poverty increases. You're seeing the front line already, but those kind of second and third tiers will also see demand going up.
And before we get on to the problems for the charities themselves in meeting that demand, how much worse is the situation in poorer areas of the country?
Yeah, poorer areas of the country don't have, as a rule, as strong a charity network. Now, that's not true everywhere, but if you have less money to go around to donate, if people are sort of working a lot of hours and have caring responsibilities, they find volunteering a lot more difficult, so you have fewer volunteers. So there is a big regional spread, a sort of place-based spread. If you do have less money, there are fewer charities around. So charities can't be the answer to everything. And we do need to look at where you can sort of stimulate charities and those support networks where there aren't many in places that are sort of more disadvantaged.
So just to be clear, the places where more poor people are likely to be less well served in terms of charities trying to help them.
Donations to charity are about 7 times higher in wealthy areas than the poorest areas. So you do see big differences in how well charities are serving different areas.
So we know the demands on charities are likely to rise. Let's look at how well off they are when trying to deal with those increased demands.
So during the pandemic, one in four charities saw their income fall by 40% or more. So you're talking a really significant chunk because they couldn't fundraise. Now looking ahead, they're basically saying, well, we know that people have less to give. We think the sector will be about £5 billion worse off than it would have been pre-pandemic. So you're talking about a very significant chunk of charity income that we don't think is going to come in this time around.
Nicole Sykes. The energy crisis is, of course, an international one. So next, I want to find out how other governments in Europe are tackling it and whether we could learn any lessons from our neighbours. Joining me in the briefing room is Nick Eyre, Professor of Energy and Climate Policy at Oxford University. Nick Eyre, what are our European neighbours doing in response to this energy problem?
Most countries in Europe are doing some of what the UK is doing, so supporting either incomes to pay bills or reducing prices through direct government subsidy for the energy companies. What is significantly different in other European countries like Italy, France, Germany, is that they have over the last few years really ramped up their energy saving programmes, whereas we've reduced ours. We've cut back ours by 80 or 90% since 2012. And that means we have higher energy bills now than we otherwise would have.
At the end of all that, how does the rise of the costs to the consumers in our European neighbours compare with ours?
In general, in European countries, particularly other northern European countries which have done more, they have got lower energy bills because they've got less energy consumption. So in some cases, like Sweden and Germany, they've got higher prices, but not necessarily higher bills. You can subsidise the prices for lower income households.
With lower tariffs for particular people?
Yes, with lower tariffs for particular people. That's already done in this country to some extent through the Warm Homes Discount. That could be increased. We're seeing those sorts of policies adopted in other countries. I noticed that Belgium is adopting the same sort of policy. Germany already subsidises through rents, low-income household energy bills. If we're to ramp that up significantly in the UK, it would really need to be subsidised by government. At the moment, the Warm Homes Discount is subsidised by a levy on all electricity bills. If we wanted the subsidy to low-income households to go from £150 to, say, £1,500, which might be the sort of number people were looking at, then that would be a huge impact on everybody else's prices if it was subsidised simply within the energy system.
Are these other countries that are subsidising bills, are they doing it by an additional levy on overall bills, or are they doing it by direct subsidy through government?
Some are doing it through a direct subsidy through government or quasi-government. If you look at France, for example, there's a price cap, but the dominant energy supplier is Electricité de France, which is very largely government-owned and soon to be 100% government-owned. And therefore, the government has got a relatively easy way of subsidising household bills just by essentially instructing EDF.
Can the UK government get bills down quickly by sourcing energy more cheaply from somewhere else, or by building up stocks ahead of the winter so that when winter comes we've got a greater availability? Or is that a longer-term policy which can't kick in time?
It's a longer-term policy option. We could store more gas, but we've actually reduced the amount of gas storage in recent years by closing the main storage facility. We could build more liquefied natural gas capacity, which would allow us to import more from countries in the Middle East, from the USA. But that takes time. Historically, LNG has been more expensive than getting the gas via pipeline from Norway and the rest of Europe.
How secure is our supply even at these prices?
It depends on all sorts of imponderables, particularly the extent to which Russia is prepared to continue exporting gas. On other factors, we've got a drought in Norway as well as in the UK. That means their hydropower capacity is being reduced. We've got serious problems with the nuclear reactors in France, which means that at the moment electricity is flowing from Britain into France, whereas historically it's largely been the other way around. So we could end up in a perfect storm. The way that the gas system security works is that households are prioritised and supplies are reduced to industry and power generation first. So more chance of power cuts than gas cuts, but the risk of power cuts clearly higher than it's been for some years.
Nick Eyre. Finally, what should we do? I want to look at the government's policy options with two leading economists, Gemma Tetlow from the Institute of Government and Duncan Weldon, author of 200 Years of Muddling Through. Gemma Tetlow, can we just start with the scale of the cost of living problem we've been hearing about? Have we reached the point, do you think, that requires drastic government intervention? In other words, are we in a pandemic-type situation?
This is a level of price rises that the UK hasn't been used to for decades. This does raise calls for government to step in and do something. But this is quite a different situation from the pandemic, because what's driving this is problems on the supply side of the economy, and particularly the high levels of energy prices around the world. The UK economy is constrained in how much it can supply without prices being driven yet higher. And at the moment, the Bank of England thinks that the economy is running pretty much at its capacity. And so in order to bring inflation under control, which ultimately will help households to no longer face this ever-growing cost of living, the Bank of England is raising interest rates to try and actually bring things back under control. What that means for the government is that the government can't actually offset all of this pain for everyone. Unfortunately, there is economic pain coming that's needed to bring inflation back under control. The government can't offset this for everyone, but the government does have a choice about how to help allocate the pain across different types of households.
Duncan, you've been nodding. Are you nodding in agreement, or just because you're the kind of person who likes to nod?
I'm nodding in agreement. I think, you know, if you look at the forecasts from the Bank of England, they say real household income, that's, you know, income once you take account of price changes, tax and benefit changes, is going to fall this year, it's going to fall next year. And it's going to be the deepest two-year drop on record. The records go back to the 1960s, so it really is a crisis. You know, essentially, the UK is a poorer country than we thought it was going to be, and there's very little the government can do in the short term to change that. So the real debate is about how we allocate that pain rather than how we make it go away.
OK, so what are the levers available, Duncan, to government in pain allocation?
To take energy bills specifically coming down the line, it could choose to not put up energy bills and for the government to instead borrow the money in the form of government debt. It could cut taxes, it could increase benefits, or it could do what we've already started doing in May and go for sort of direct rebates to households, giving them cash to help pay their bills.
Chairman, let's look at the specific problem of getting help to the people who are most in need, because I sense that in the middle of this, there's a major distribution and redistribution question. How could the government use the benefit system to target this group more effectively?
Our benefit system typically gives more money to people who are judged to be unable to work, whether for health reasons or for caring responsibilities, to larger families than to single people, for example, and to pensioners versus working age people. So that's how our benefit system is currently set up. So one option for the government in trying to provide help with the cost of living would be simply to scale up the existing benefit system, increase the rate that everyone's getting. Actually, what the government has so far done has been to do things that give more of a lump sum payment either to everyone or to just benefit recipients or just to pensioners. So doing something that's a bit less related to the size of people's families, for example.
Duncan, I'd ask this question even if there wasn't effectively a prime ministerial election going on. So let's try and put that out of our mind for the moment. What about the question of cutting people's taxes versus increasing benefits?
I mean, cutting taxes is quite a blunt instrument, but doesn't really address the problem we have. You know, one idea on the table at the moment from Liz Truss, if she becomes Prime Minister, is to cancel the increase in national insurance contributions that we had in April this year. And you can cancel that, but for a start, it won't help pensioners. It won't help people who are not in work. And even people in work, you're talking, depending on how much they earn, £150, £250. You know, in the context of bills going up by £2,000 or more, I mean, it really doesn't touch the sides.
In other words, if the problem is the one we've talked about dealing with here, tax cuts aren't going to be a way of dealing with it. Increasing benefits conceivably could be. But if we do just use the benefit system, would some people still slip through the gap?
I mean, I worry that the scale of the problem we are now facing goes beyond the benefit system. The benefit system is really effective at targeting money at the poorest people. If we're talking about average domestic energy bills going above £4,000, then there are households, quite well-off households, households in the middle of the income distribution, households even above the average, who are going to struggle.
Can we look at specific ways of dealing with those energy bills now, in addition to anything we might do through the benefit system? What else is out there? How much impact would doing things like scrapping VAT on bills or the Green Levy have, Gemma?
Scrapping VAT on energy bills or the sorts of reductions in the Green Levies. So Rishi Sunak has talked about scrapping VAT on bills and Liz Truss has talked about getting rid of the Green Levies. Both of those policies would cut perhaps £150 off the typical annual household bill. So as Duncan just said, that's pretty small.
Duncan Weldon, what we've heard about what other countries are doing is that some of them are simply using government finance to defray the bills. Some of them buy quite a lot of money. And some people here are proposing essentially doing that right up to the level of the projected autumn rise. What would you make of that?
The International Monetary Fund put out a really good bit of research on this recently, looking at how countries across Europe are responding. I agree that as a first principle, it is best to let the bills rise so that you're maintaining this signal that energy is expensive, people try and use less of it, the price signal, but at the same time to compensate households. So rather than just saying the government is going to keep the cap where it is, let the cap rise and give the households that need it more money is better. Now, the problem with either approach is this really depends on how long we think energy prices are going to be this high for. So the proposal from the Liberal Democrats just that the government should swallow up that bill increase and pay for it, they've costed that £36 billion. That's already a very big number. It could end up being an awful lot more than that if energy prices are staying high for the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Gemma, do you agree that essentially that may not be the way to go? Firstly, it suggests to people that energy is much cheaper than it is, and in the long term, we've got to get our heads around conservation. And secondly, it is just too expensive for what it achieves.
I would certainly agree with the first part of that it is actually quite important to retain the incentives for people to cut back on their energy usage, particularly for those households that can afford to, that they continue to have that price signal that Duncan talks about. The question about whether it's just too expensive, in part, this goes back to the points we were making at the start about the fact that the government can't actually absorb all of this cost for everyone. So if the government were to keep the cap lower and absorb that extra cost, then actually that's going to be matched by further increases in interest rates from the Bank of England. So other costs coming onto households that perhaps are less obvious. Also, Duncan's absolutely right to say that there's a real issue about how long energy prices remain high for. As it stands, all the support that's been announced is going to expire at the end of March next year. If the latest forecasts are correct, that energy prices remain very high for much longer than that, it could be really much larger sums of money required to keep compensating people beyond that.
We have heard that in countries like Belgium, for example, they've got what I think you might describe as a middle way, whereby you effectively have a lower tariff for people in poorer households.
Yes, the sort of social tariffs, I think you'd refer to them as. It is a solution. You retain the price signal whilst helping protect lower income households. But again, it will be quite expensive.
Let's talk about the complexity, which you referred to at the beginning, which you throw into all this, which is the worries that the Bank of England has about the threat of inflation and a recession. How do the options we've discussed feed in to the problems of inflation and the possibility of a recession, Gemma?
Looking at the Bank of England's latest forecast, they don't think that inflation is going to come back to its 2% target for several years. So reading between the lines almost suggests that the Bank of England thinks that a recession is necessary to bring inflation under control. And so if the government were to put a lot of public money into compensating households for these higher costs, that's likely to be offset at an aggregate level by higher interest rates from the Bank of England to try and continue to be on a path to bring inflation under control. That will still drag on households' incomes and well-being. In a sense, that is a necessary pain.
So the Bank of England's response to the inflationary threat is to put interest rates up and create a recession to bring inflation down. To a lot of people, they think, well, we don't want a recession, so maybe we'd rather have the inflation. Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, we should be absolutely clear. When we talk about central banks controlling inflation, what we mean is they make it harder for firms to borrow. They want to slow the economy, make hiring more difficult, increase unemployment, slow wage growth. That's how you bring down inflation. It's not a pleasant process. What the argument is that in the long run, a bit more unemployment, a bit more hardship in the next year and a half, no one wants it, but it is better for everyone in the long run than out of control inflation, is how the bank would answer that.
And by and large, you'd buy that thesis too.
I think it's a matter of degree. I think, you know, at the moment, I think the bank is probably tightening a bit faster than it needs to. But I think the general principle, yes.
Gemma, do you agree?
I would agree with that. And the bank faces a challenge of bringing individuals and businesses' expectations of future inflation under control. What it needs to achieve is that people don't expect prices to rise in future, so they don't feel the need to push for ever higher wages and for businesses to put up their prices. The bank is trying to calibrate its response to do enough that people believe inflation will be brought under control.
Duncan Weldon, that actually suggests that if you're worried about the inflationary effect of significant subsidies and you're worried about the additional borrowing, one way in which you would deal with it, far from being tax cuts, would be tax increases.
I mean, look, if you look where the Bank of England is at the moment, the Bank of England is saying, we think unemployment is going to rise for the next 3 years. We think Britain's going to be stuck in recession next year. And despite that, we're going to have the single biggest interest rate rise in 27 years. And we're going to keep increasing interest rates next year. Gemma is right. The bank is sending the message, we think a recession is necessary to bring inflation down. And if that's the message the bank is sending, then as the government adds more support into the economy, they will raise interest rates faster. Now, that might actually be a better policy mix than where we are now. You know, if the government chooses to help lower and middle income households by borrowing more, and the bank responds by putting up interest rates more, then yes, the economy is still in recession, but the distributional impact of that looks a bit different.
Gemma, is that because higher interest rates affect lower earners and poorer people less than they do people on higher incomes?
That's right. One of the big impacts of higher interest rates will obviously be for mortgage borrowers. Many people are on fixed rate mortgages, but a lot of those will start to roll over and people will face higher mortgage costs. And actually, the lowest income households typically don't own their own properties. So it will tend to be middle and higher income ones will be affected through that channel.
Okay, so I think it's now time to make your recommendations to the Chancellor, who currently is Nadeem Zahawi. And I think we have to imagine that he's dealing with these problems right now, not putting everything off until the leadership election is resolved. Duncan, which of these combination of policy measures would you recommend in order to remind ourselves of our objective here, to make sure that poorer people in society are not terribly badly affected by what's currently happening?
I would let the energy price cap rise, as Ofgem suggests. I would pay a very large rebate, and you know, direct cash transfer to the bottom 30 or even 40% of households, and a smaller rebate to the next sort of third of households. And as I did that, I would do it fully aware in the knowledge that the Bank of England was likely to raise interest rates faster as a result. But that's the price we would have to pay.
And Gemma?
I would agree with what Duncan said. So just to add one more point into the mix, I think particularly given that the forecasts now suggest energy prices could remain higher for quite a bit longer, I would also be thinking about a set of policies we haven't talked about yet to encourage households to make energy efficiency improvements to their households and subsidise that, particularly for poorer households, to help control energy costs.
So you would launch, and Duncan's nodding at this, you would launch a big campaign to get people to use less energy?
Correct, including helping with the cost of making relatively simple adaptations to homes like loft insulation, that sort of thing.
As a priority?
As a priority, yes.
I think as a general priority, you know, we need to be investing in insulation, we need to be investing in renewables, nuclear, the energy mix. These are all really important things, but they're not going to have an impact in the next 6-7 months.
Duncan Weldon there with Gemma Tetlow. My thanks to them and to Felicity Hannah, Nicole Sykes and Nick Eyre. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirsty Knight, Bob Howard and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Graham Puttifoot and the editor was Richard Varden. If you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune into the one about whether Britain can adapt to heat waves. And there's also an edition about whether the dispute over Taiwan could lead to war in East Asia.
Hi, I'm Andy Oliver, and I'd like to tell you all about my Radio 4 series, One Dish. It's all about why you love that one dish, the one that you could eat over and over again without ever getting tired of it. Each week, a very special guest will bring their favourite food to my table and we'll be unpacking the history of it. And food psychologist Kimberly Wilson is on hand to talk us through the science bit. What food reminds you of your childhood? What's your favourite place to go for dinner? What do you have for Sunday lunch? What's your favourite dessert? Do you say plantain or plantain? What food would you take with you to a desert island? What's your favourite type of chilli oil? What do you have for breakfast? What's the best pasta? What's the one thing you... So if you're the sort of person who's already planning what you're having for lunch while you're eating breakfast, then this podcast is going to be right up your street. That's One Dish with me, Andy Oliver. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.